Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to have my guest today, Bruce Allison, professional arborist, and he's been with us a number of times to talk about trees and shrubs, and it's a pretty good time to talk about it. There are a lot of things, sort of little issues in the air that we can talk about. As I mentioned before this show, we've got the emerald ash borer, we've got gypsy moths, we've got not pruning oak trees after April 1st. There's a lot of things to discuss, including selecting trees. This is the time of year I think a lot of us think about, I need a new tree in the backyard. I lost the old one, or I lost a couple, and what should I be considering planting this year? These are all things that Bruce can talk with you about, and I'm certainly glad to have the topics widened even further. So, trees and shrubs on the agenda today. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234. If you're in Madison, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. Bruce Allison, welcome back. Nice to have you with us again.
Well, Larry, great to be back with you and your audience.
Tell you what, you put out a little fact sheet here, a little story you have a number of things on it, but one of the items you have is titled New Tools for Tree Decay Detection, and you look a little bit like a doctor plugging some pretty fancy things into what looks like a pretty big oak tree, maybe.
You know, Larry, in the many years that I've been in the field of arboriculture, the changes, especially in technology, are just unbelievable. In the past, if you had a tree that had any sort of defect or was problematic structurally, it was a matter of just guessing as to whether or not it was going to fail and how it might fail. These days, we have tools that allow us to literally see inside trees. There is the most promising technology, and there's now some new actually tools released, is called sonic tomography. And, of course, people who have had CAT scans and MRIs know that tomography is really just a computer-generated picture of the inside of something. And what we do with the trunks of trees is to actually put sensors around the trunk, a circumference of the trunk, and then manually produce a sound wave and then measure the speed which that sound wave is propagated through the trunk, and then the computer, by measuring that time of flight and the distances, is able to generate a tomograph to tell the acoustic characteristics of trees, the inside of that tree. As anyone who's ever hit a drum or anything hollow knows, the sound propagates faster through solid wood than it does through cavities or decayed wood. And that's really the science behind this acoustic tomography. So it's remarkable. Suddenly we can actually tell somebody, yes, 40% of the interior part of your tree is gone, and therefore it's now a hazard. Another tool that's really very useful and is now being very widely distributed is something called the resistograph. And that is a very small micro drill. The head of it is only 3 millimeters. The shaft itself is only 1.5 millimeters. It's like a little needle going
right
through. And with a hand drill, it is then put into the wood of the tree. And there's a machine that measures the torque resistance. So you can actually tell how much resistance that wood is producing against that drill. And, of course, the greater resistance means that it's more solid wood and that it passes through decayed or even a hollow. And all of that is measured on a graph. So you see the higher amplitude measurements tell you when you have solid wood. And of interest, you can actually see on these sensitive tools every time you pass through an annual ring, because an annual ring has the early wood, which is going to be less dense, and then the late wood, where things start to slow down and the cells become much closer together, there's a lot more cell wall, is more dense. And so you see these little bumps up and down. So it's a way to actually tell the age and, count those annual rings of trees. So very sensitive tools. I mean, they're not inexpensive, as all new technology isn't, but it really gives the arborist, just a tremendous advantage over what we used to have to be able to tell a homeowner or municipality if they have a tree that is structurally unsound.
Yeah, it's amazing technology, and you've got it shown very nicely here. And I'm kind of a fact sheet or news sheet that you send out to people. Yeah, very, very nice. Well, I tell you what, we have every line filled. So let's go to the phone and find out what's on everybody's mind, including Bob and Stevens Point. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi. I'm looking for a tree that I can put close to my house, you know, for shade and such. And I've been told autumn blaze maple may be a good choice. And I'm wondering, is that one that has general good branching habits? Is the strength of the wood okay to put close to a house? You know, by close, I mean 20 feet away. Is it drought tolerant, disease, insect resistance? You know, general growth habits for that tree.
And
any comments?
What's your soil? You're at Stevens Point, so is it you got a kind of a sandy soil there, or is it more clay? Or
well, depending where I put this tree, if I buy more than one, part of my soil would be just pure sand, and another part would be, let's say, 30 inches of sand and then clay below it. So
okay.
And well, I'll hang up and listen off here.
Okay, great, Bob. Well, you certainly have mentioned a tree that is very popular. It's one of those new trees which are a cross between the Freeman Eye, which is one of the red maples, and a silver maple. Silver maples we don't normally think of having really good structural characteristics, especially near buildings. But when crossed with that Freeman Eye, you end up getting some very interesting characteristics, better branching structure, more resistance to decay, but you still maintain that fast growth. You can get upwards of a foot per year of growth on this tree, which makes it very popular. There are varieties that will give you very nice color displays, especially in the fall. So it's a tree that, yes, is becoming more popular. It certainly is not going to have that longevity and extreme resistance to decay that, say, an oak would. But, of course, the oak is going to grow so much more slowly over time. So, yes, I would say that especially if you're looking for fairly fast shade and you want some interesting color, that it would be an appropriate tree to plant in that residential setting.
Great. Thank you very much for calling. And Pat in Marshfield, it's your turn now. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thank you. I'm wondering if Bruce would be able to recommend anything that would grow on my west property line, which is shaded by the neighbor's white pines.
Hmm. So it's your west property line.
Right. So it will get sun until about 2 in the afternoon.
Until about 2 or so.
And are you thinking trees or shrubs here?
I was thinking shrubs, but almost anything that would grow. I have had arborvitae in, and they are not doing very well.
Yeah, and so you'd like some screening is really
right.
Your landscape purpose.
Right.
Well, think about some of the yews. There are some new varieties of yews, which are the Taxus capitata. That's just the scientific name. Taxus
right.
Means the yew. Capitata means capital yew. And if you were to find some of those, they tend to have the same growth, pyramidal growth shape that the arborvitae do. And that's why the arborvitae are so desirable. They really grow up nicely, and you can create a nice screen. They have good color and shape. But you're right, they're not as shade tolerant as some others, whereas the yews are more shade tolerant. Now, the negative is, of course, they're going to grow more slowly. That sunlight obviously is the energy source to allow the carbohydrates to be produced, which is the source of growth. But nonetheless, if you were to buy, you know, even if you could, a 4 or 5 foot capital U, and they're not that expensive,
okay.
And then just attend to all of those other variables that are important for growth, that is appropriate soil nutrients and adequate water, you might get the maximum amount of growth, even though you have a limited amount of sunlight. In a shaded area, other people will also choose, staying with the conifers, the yews. The hemlocks. Hemlock is going to be a very different type of plant in that it, in its full form, of course, is a large forest-type tree, so it'll grow quite tall over time. Slow growing and a little sensitive to get established. So if you're looking just for a screen, and it doesn't have to be, you know, 50 feet tall, you'd be happy with ultimately, you know, 10 to 20 feet tall, then I would point you in the direction of the capital U. I think that would be a good choice for you.
All right.
But make sure it's a capital U and not just one of the Japanese U.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Pat. Lynn in Westby, it's your turn. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Good morning. I have a question about lilacs.
Okay.
We have some lilacs that have been here a long, long time, and they've gotten very leggy to the point that I can't reach the blooms to cut them off for flower decoration or whatever. And they're looking pretty bad, too. They've been kind of neglected, so there's a lot of suckers on them. Is it possible to shorten them up and make them more bushy again? And how to do that?
It sure is. Do you have a shade issue with those lilacs? Is something forcing them to grow more upright, looking for sunlight, do you think?
They're in between the house and very, very tall arborvitaes.
So maybe they've become, you know, the environment, the micro environment has changed over years. Well, making sure that you can introduce adequate amount of sunlight, because you're not going to get good blossoms on lilacs if there's insufficient sunlight.
Well, they're blossoming well. It's just that the blossoms are so high up.
Are high up, exactly. Mm-hmm. So they're probably, you know, producing some shade against themselves also. Well, what you're asking is rejuvenation pruning, and with lilacs, they respond very, very well to that. What you would like to do, ideally, is to maybe take upwards of a third of those stems out.
Completely out.
Completely out, and bringing them all the way back down to the ground so you don't leave a stump that starts to decay and other growth comes off of that, and eventually the decay causes the whole stem to fail. So a thinning out by taking out the larger, most leggy, that is the most upright of those stems, and therefore reducing the height generally of the cluster of lilac.
Okay.
Favor those more juvenile, the younger ones that seem to be vigorous to you lower down. In some cases, at least initially, quite often it takes upwards of 3 years to complete a successful rejuvenation pruning.
Okay.
What you might choose to do is head back or reduce the height of some of those leggy ones, thinking eventually you'll take them out. But that will let more sunlight penetrate lower down. You'll get some new growth coming from the base of those trees. But if you do head back, make sure that the branch that you cut back to is at least one-third the diameter of the larger branch you're cutting back. Do you follow me on that one?
Are you talking about...
Heading back now. Heading back is just taking off rather than the entire stem, part of the stem.
So first you're pruning a third out of the largest, and then you're looking at these other stems.
Well,
okay. Is that correct?
My thinking is if you felt it was too much to take out a third of those large stems all at one time, and you wanted to be more gradual, what you could do is take out some of those large stems and then the others leave in place but reduce their height, and that's called heading back. But you're heading back to a lower lateral branch coming off. You don't want to leave a stub. You want to actually go back to that branch, but don't make the mistake of leaving too small of a branch. You want to leave a branch that has a diameter at the connection to the main stem at least one-third the diameter of the bigger stem that you're cutting back. And the reason for that is these plants are like great water fountains. Water has to be distributed throughout there. And if you are going from a large stem and you have too small a stem to go back to, that smaller stem, which through its evaporation of water is pulling the water molecules up from lower down, that's the pumping action, then you have insufficient pumping action to pull an adequate amount of water to service the stem lower down, and therefore you'll have dieback occurring. So you want that stem that you're cutting to be at least one-third the diameter of the one you're heading back.
Good luck. Thanks very much for calling.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Lynn. Kurt, in Glen Ellen, Illinois, you are coming up next. But first, I want to remind everybody, you are hearing Bruce Allison speak today, professional arborist, works out of the Madison area, author of Every Root and Anchor and Wisconsin's Champion Trees. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, on this edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking trees and shrubs today with Bruce Allison. Thank you for listening in. We'll go to Kurt in Glen Ellen, Illinois next. Kurt, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I have two maple trees on my property that last season, you know, they get those helicopter seeds on them, and last season they never let loose. They hung on all winter. They're still there. Is that something that I need to worry about? Something I, you know, need to do something for?
Yeah, well, that's interesting. It certainly is not normal.
No.
And Kurt, Glen Ellen's a beautiful suburb, small town. I remember driving through that, just a beautiful forest cover there.
Yeah, thank you very much. It is nice.
Do you know what species maples these are?
I don't. I was listening, and I know they're not like a red or a silver.
Okay.
I've been told they're a soft-wooded maple.
Okay.
But, you know, they're just maples, your average maples.
Hmm.
I have three on the property. One of them, you know, it let go of all its helicopters, but two of them didn't.
Yeah, that's very unusual to have that happen. In fact, it's just to that level of being rare that you do not have successful drop of those. And none of the seeds dropped, just...
Well, I would imagine some probably did, but no, I mean, I can, you know...
90-some percent are still there.
Exactly.
Okay. Are the trees vigorous at all? Are they still growing, or are they in trouble? I mean, sometimes you can have fruit, you know, maintained because the tree is dying, and you don't have sufficient carbohydrates to complete the process of maturation of the seed and drying. But usually, you know, if they're going to go through normal maturation, they're going to dry and be dropping in great abundance.
Yeah, they seem healthy to me. One's young. One's probably only about 6-7 years old. The other one is old. I mean, it was there when I bought the property like 20 years ago.
Hmm. Well, you've got me stumped there.
Okay.
I've never heard of that occurrence where you did not have, you know, with a normative tree, successful drop. And is that ever happened before?
No.
Okay. Because I'm just simply drying out along with those leaves drying out. You know, they will simply, you know, release those seeds as they desiccate because there's, as you observe, there's very little attachment at that point. So I'm guessing that there is some lack of vigor going on, and that might become evident this spring if you do not have very successful shoot elongation and bud break.
Now, what would you do to sort of rejuvenate the trees or do your best to at least give them every chance?
Well, you'd have to get a good diagnosis first. Mm-hmm. And I think this is certainly symptomatic of a problem. And, you know, so adequate water would be important. But, you know, I would bring this question to a local garden center, maybe start there, or if you have an arborist that you deal with, present that, or if you have a county extension agent, you know, present that question, and maybe even get a digital picture and you know, email that to somebody who is an authority in your area and try to resolve that when you might have one of the most rarest of trees here. You can make clones of it. It's the maple that won't drop its seed.
Good luck, Kurt.
Right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All
Kurt.
Right. Thanks very much for calling. And let's go to Mary Beth in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Mary Beth, hi.
Hi. I'm so pleased to be able to talk to you.
You're listening online.
Thank you for webcasting.
Yeah, you're listening online. Great.
Oh, yes, every day. Wisconsin Public Radio is the best around.
Thank you.
I need an expert's opinion. After living for 20 years in a townhome just south of Washington, D.C., I now have a one-acre lot, and I want it all. I'd like some balsam or spruce to make a windbreak and a sight screen. I'd like some maple trees for tapping and for some color, and I'd like to have maybe a few apple trees thrown in, too. And I'd like the whole thing to look natural. One corner of my one-acre lot.
Okay.
Well, there you are. You've got some good choices there, the balsam fir and the spruce. Without knowing the, you know, details of your soil and the siting that you have, it's going to be
good
pretty...
soil with lots of sunlight.
Good soil mean a silt loam, had been agricultural before, Mary Beth?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and moisture conditions, not excessive moisture, not in a low spot, fairly well drained?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay. Well, that I used to live in, when I first graduated from college, I spent some time near Yorkville, Pennsylvania, in that southern part, Yorktown rather, which was very beautiful, and there were many, many sugar bushes in that area and further to the north.
That's what I call my backyard, the sugar bush.
The sugar bush. Well, and of course, then your choice of maples is going to be limited. You're going to have sugar maples, and there are many different cultivated varieties. Green Mountain is one that's quite popular. The sugar maple, I mean, all the maples will produce a high sugar content in their sap, but the sugar maples happen to have the highest. And, of course, with all that effort that you have to put into tapping them, you want to maximize the amount of available sugar.
Right.
So I would start right now planting an appropriate number of the sugar maples. But visit your University of Pennsylvania website and see how much information they have on sugar bush production. They probably have a bulletin that will give you point by point how to do it and the current recommended cultivars to be planting. If not, the University of Massachusetts does an excellent job on that. They have a very, very sophisticated website to visit and many good bulletins on that. So make sure that you follow those recommendations.
Probably through their extension?
Through the extension, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we have coming online pretty soon something called e-extension, which the federal government is really promoting. Larry probably knows a lot about this, too. That we're trying to take the best of all those land-grant universities and put together those bulletins in special areas so that we're not all duplicating and try to be more efficient, and it's going to be all available electronically online. It's called the e-bulletin or e-extension is coming out.
How will that be up and running, and how would I access it?
Well, I would start by going to your University of Pennsylvania and University of Mass. I think those are the best for sugar maples, and just just start with those, and just simply Google sugar bush or maple syrup, and I'm sure they will be pulled up. But start with that. The extension is not really fully functioning yet, but we're not far from it. So that's your sugar bush, and to make it natural, of course, you don't want to have it in long lines. You want to have the trees distributed more randomly as you would expect in a forest setting. For your apples, I strongly encourage you, if you're not desiring to do regular spraying, to find those that are scab resistant. Scab is your most difficult aspect in an apple orchard, because there's really no way to get around it. If you have a scab-susceptible apple, you really have to put on those fungicides. If you want to have a smaller number of trees and don't want to get involved in that more complicated process of spraying, then use your scab-resistant variety. And there's many available that different nurseries that specialize in fruit trees like Hilltop and Starks and others will be able to deliver online, be able to deliver a mail order, and you can get your apple orchard started that way. But definitely choose the scab resistant. You have very good varieties, Jonifree, Macfree, Liberty. There's plenty of them out there. With your conifers, make sure you put your conifers, be they balsam fir or your spruce, in a position that they're not going to be a problem in the future. That is, if you have a beautiful view off to a pond or something, well, then that's not the area to put your spruce trees. Even though they might look fine when they're small, they're going to grow taller and interfere with your views. So be focused on views. And then on those, again, if you want to create a natural setting, don't put them in a plantation planting. That is, evenly spaced lines, but rather, again, a more random distribution, even if they're just offset back and forth.
Does that mean that I can plant them, a couple of them too close together, and then maybe leave a little extra space between them and the next one?
Yeah, well, again, be careful about too close. People mistakenly don't plan for the future in that sense that these trees can grow pretty big, and so you want to say, all right, well, in 10 years, they're going to be adding an extra, 6 feet on either horizontal side, and therefore I do not want to have these bumped up against each other. I want to have a little bit more spacing. And that's better to make it look natural, but also in terms of disease issues. I mean, in Pennsylvania, you're going to have problems like rhizosphera later on, so you want to have good ventilation around there and good sunlight exposure to dry out those needles quickly. But I think if you do that, and start now, the best time to plant a tree was yesterday, and the second best time is today.
It's snowing today.
Well, today meaning just generally very soon. Of course, we're approaching the vernal equinox, so spring is coming right up. So you probably will be able to get them in the ground as early 4 weeks from now. But plan now and plan carefully and get those catalogs and start visiting local nurseries so that you really know what you want to do, and then put a stake in the ground to identify where you want them, and then think again about how big they're going to be over time, mm-hmm. so that you don't accidentally create a problem 10 years down the road and have to correct it.
Yep. Good luck, Mary Beth.
Thank you both so very, very much.
Thanks for listening. Appreciate it very much. We will take some more calls. Always nice to hear from folks from out of state. And let's go back in state. Talk to Frank in Cross Plains. Hi, Frank.
Hello. Glad to talk to you. My question is, I have a huge, I believe it's a soft maple tree in my yard. And it's like maybe 4.5-5 foot wide at the base. Hmm. I mean, just a huge tree. And it's really old. And I've over the years, a few limbs have been lopped off to trim it back because it's nearer the house. And I noticed that last year that I have like two holes, one on each where a limb has been lopped off, that are developing into the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering what to do, if I should try and plug those with some kind of material, seal them up. They're about maybe 2-2.5 inches wide. You can stick a broom handle in, maybe 3 or 4 inches.
So they're on they're on the main scaffold limbs. Yes. They're not on the trunk themselves. Okay.
The main trunk, actually.
Okay, and very typical.
Well, the limbs were cut off close to the trunk.
Okay. Very typical to have on a silver maple, and that's clearly what it is.
Okay.
After a pruning cut is made, a cavity formed. And there's not much you can do about that. I mean, each tree has its own its own life strategy. Sugar maples tend to grow more slowly, but they put a lot of energy into decay resistance. Silver maples grow very quickly, which is what people want, often that immediate shade. But they do that at the expense of longevity. They just don't put the energy into building cell walls that are more resistant to decay. So when you have a pruning cut, and of course every pruning cut is a wound, and that's the point of entry of saprophytic, or that is deadwood-eating decay. And, of course, as you know, the interior part of a tree is all deadwood. The only live part is, if you would imagine, a skin which surrounds the entire tree, and that's the only active growing part of that tree. And so once you have pierced that with the pruning cut, you then have introduced these decay organisms that then start working on the inside, and quite rapidly, unfortunately, on the silver maples, and that's why you're developing a cavity, which is the end stage of digesting. So what does that mean? Well, it means that you are losing that cross-sectional stability of that particular limb, and if it gets down to a certain point, usually we think about 40% cross-sectional area gone to decay, then you have a tree that's at high risk for breaking. And there's nothing to be done about that. We, in the past, used to put concrete in there and fill it with foam and everything else.
Great stuff.
Yeah. All that did, it was just create an environment more conducive to the decay. It just accelerated that decomposition of wood around the base of it. The best thing to stop decay is sunshine, okay, light, and air. And you know that just by dealing with molds on bread. If you get a wet piece of bread, put it in a dark closet, that the hypha of the fungus will grow very quickly. But if you take that same piece of bread and put it out in the sunlight with plenty of ventilation and air moving around it, it's not a very good environment for decay. Well, the same thing is happening within that tree. So keeping it open. And one of the thought, when you do further pruning, you can minimize the opportunity for decay entering by pruning properly. That is, rather than making a totally flush cut back to the trunk or back to the large scaffold limb when you take that branch off, instead, find that ring of cells that's called the branch bark collar. It's at the junction of a lateral stem and then the mother stem that it's connected to. You'll see that nature has evolved this particular ring, a special set of cells that when the branch dies or is cut off, if that ring is in place, that branch bark collar is in place, those cells will grow quite rapidly and form a callus or closure of that wound. And, of course, once it's closed, then you have, again, protected it from that decay, less likely to get a very significant cavity going on.
Well, you know, when I had cut one of these limbs off and, you know, it started growing over like that, I believe that's what you're talking about.
Yes.
That it grew over and grew over. And I had painted it with this black material, kind of a tar.
Yes.
And this has probably been 20 years almost, and that is where I'm getting one of the holes right now.
Okay,
it is growing over kind of.
Yes,
but probably just not much I can do now, though.
There's probably not a lot you can do. And when I first started, you know, 3 decades ago as an arborist, as a young guy climbing those trees, we would always carry a paint pot of this asphalt paint up in the trees, and the rule of thumb would be if it's bigger than a quarter, that is the pruning wound, it has to be painted. It wasn't long thereafter where the USDA, the U.S. Forest Service, doing research, empirical research, discovered that putting that tree paint on, again, created an environment more conducive to decay, and consequently, with very few exceptions, the recommendation is not to paint those wounds, but again, to let that air. And your biggest problem is not so much necessarily how it was cut or whether or not you put tree paint on, but just the genetic characteristics of that soft maple.
Mm. Good luck. Thanks a lot, Frank, for calling. Yeah, appreciate it. Frank in Cedarburg, you are next. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Have a question on ash trees. I'd like to use an insecticide in order to get insecticide to go into the tree and hopefully kill the green beetle that they're talking about.
The emerald ash borer.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
Well, the emerald ash borer has not been discovered in Wisconsin yet. It's in Illinois, just on the southern border, or near the southern border of the state, I mean, apparently within 40 miles or less. So we're fearful that it will enter over time. But the State Department of Ag and Consumer Protection and the Wisconsin DNR are not recommending the application of any pesticides for the emerald ash borer at this point because, again, it hasn't been discovered. And when it is, you know, the recommendations may change, but the goal is to have eradication if there is a pocket found. And so that means that in our state, if indeed one emerald ash borer is found and identified as such, and it's a very careful process of identifying it, actually has to be sent out of state to Michigan for clear identification, then all of those ash trees within a half-mile radius will be removed, that is, eradicated. So, and then it hopes to stop the insect at that particular point for that particular infestation. So the recommendation is not to be treating with imidacloprid, which is the soil-applied insecticide that for other problems like bronze birch borer and two-line chestnut borer on oaks, whatever, is very effective and is being used extensively in other states for the emerald ash borer and the Asian longhorn beetle, where infestations have gone beyond that eradication program and are into the management program. We're not there yet, so clearly it would be you're ahead of yourself. You got the right idea, but you're ahead of yourself in terms of timing and usefulness for the application of that pesticide. Mm-hmm.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Louise in Spring Green next. Hi, Louise.
Larry, thanks so much for your show.
Sure.
I enjoy every one of them. I love hibiscus trees. They aren't hardy around here for outdoors. So I bought a hibiscus bush. It is called a Hibiscus syriacus blushing bride althea.
Huh.
And I want to train it as a tree. I was just thinking trim it up from the bottom. Any hints, suggestions?
Well, certainly, yeah, creating that, you know, illusion of a trunk by taking off some of those lower branches would be appropriate. And then trying to create as much as you can with that particular plant an appearance of scaffold limbs, that is, you know, a scaffold structure to it. But it's not going to be 100% cooperative with you, and I think you'll probably have to go back on a pretty regular basis annually to do some corrective pruning to kind of give it more of that shape. Watch out for rabbits around that if you're in a, you know.
Oh, yeah. We have lots of those.
Okay.
Over here.
Yep. So certainly protect it, you know, during especially those winter months when the choices for the rabbits have been diminished. But good luck with that. It sounds like a wonderful idea. And, yeah, hibiscus can be just an absolutely gorgeous plant. And it's going to be, you know, pretty sensitive to the winter, so protect it as much as you can. And certainly plant it in the right location in the microclimate so that it tends not to get that blast of warmth from masonry nearby and then a quick freeze. That's often what does plants in during the winter.
And thanks again for calling. Appreciate it very much. Bruce Allison, our guest, professional arborist, owner of Allison Tree Care in the Madison area. Our guest today, I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. If you have a question for Bruce Allison today as we talk trees and shrubs, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Bruce, a couple things to just sort of clear up before we move on with earlier calls here. Our caller who called from Pennsylvania and was interested in information about maple syrup and maple trees. Actually, it's the Penn State University.
Oh, it's Penn State is the land grant, exactly. Thank
Penn
you.
Penn State's the land grant,
yep.
And I went online there, and there's a lot of information.
Excellent.
Right there. And then someone else called and wondered if with the trees, the maple trees with the helicopters attached, if that was maybe not a maple tree. And maybe it was a box elder.
Well, you'll have to check on that one. And, of course, the box elder is Acer negundo. Acer is the maple genus. And so it's often called an ash leaf maple. And mm-hmm. So it's not so easy to differentiate those, although box elders tend to have just a generally more scraggly appearance,
and, they sure do.
And they certainly can hold on to their seed even into the winter. The other characteristic of a box elder is that the stems tend to be green. That mm-hmm. is, the smaller stems coming out there, they have this wonderful characteristic for them to have chlorophyll within the stem itself, and so they can continue to have photosynthesis even after the leaves drop, and that's why they can grow so quickly.
Well, Gene in Knapp, Wisconsin, is next, so let's go to Gene. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks much. I'm looking at planting several thousand conifers here and found the white fir has many of the characteristics with respect to growth and wood style or whatever. Do you have any familiarity with white fir growing around up in west central Wisconsin? Or,
Yeah, in West Central, so that's where Knapp is?
Yeah, it's we're, you know, 50 miles west of Menominee.
Yeah. Well, it's in climate zone 4A for the white fur Abies concolor, which should cover your area. It tends to like dry soils. Do you have a fairly dry soil there?
It'd be hillside.
On a hillside, okay.
So the drainage should be good.
Should be good.
It's a soil is a heavier soil as opposed to sand.
So a little more clay in there.
Right.
It's alluvial soil, I take it, a little heavier clay soil.
Mm-hmm.
Gene, as you drive around, do you see on other neighboring properties within a 40-mile radius other white fir growing there successfully?
Well, that's what I was asking. I mean, we've got Fraser fir, balsam fir that grow in the area without any problem.
Okay.
But the... it's crummier wood.
Okay, but I mean, what I'm asking is, I know you want to plant that. Have you seen other people successfully planting that particular species? I know you've got the Fraser and whatever. Have you seen white fir immediately nearby?
I don't know.
Okay,
I haven't. Yeah, you know, it's like I couldn't recognize it without looking very closely at it, as compared to the other types
to the other
fir,
types of fir,
yeah. Which is typically grown for Christmas trees, as opposed to timber.
Yeah,
right.
Well, it's certainly, if you've got those other firs growing, the white fir should grow also successfully there, and it has this such a nice flat needle. I mean, it really just a wonderful aromatic scent if you were to take some of those needles and crush them. It's really a very desirable tree. And you're going to be buying it from a nursery, or are you going to get it from the DNR?
Well, DNR doesn't supply it because it's non-native.
Okay.
There's a nursery in Michigan that does...
That you can get them from.
Right. And I'm also going to be looking to see if there isn't somebody in Wisconsin, which would be better.
Mm-hmm.
In Michigan, but
it's certainly within that climate zone is rated for that. It grows very successfully in many other parts of the state that I'm very familiar with. In the southern part of the state, there's no problem whatsoever. All firs are a little bit more subject to winter damage, desiccation that can occur from that, and so be a little careful of that, that you're not getting a lot of wind and drying out, especially in the winter months in that particular locale. And if you want to be a little cautious and have got the time, you might want to just plant a smaller number initially, monitor it very carefully for moisture issues so that you have an adequate amount of moisture during those first 2 years for development, and just see how well they successfully overwinter in that particular site. But generally speaking, my answer to you would be, I see no reason why the Abies concolor wouldn't do well in that particular spot.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any knowledge of any plantations in Wisconsin that are successfully growing the white fir
and selling it?
Well, yeah. I mean,
Okay.
Yeah, I personally don't. But again, if you were to check with your county extension agent or a forester, they should be able to answer that pretty quickly.
Yep. Good luck. Thanks, Gene, very much for calling. And, lots of callers online. Let's go to Joy in Winchester next. Hi, Joy.
Hi there. I have a question about an Amur choke cherry. About 8 or so years ago, I planted a clump of 3 stems of Amur choke cherry. So these stems are very close together. And the trees grew wonderfully for a number of years. And then 2 years ago, I noticed that 2 of the stems were not thriving, leafing out later, smaller leaves, just not looking as healthy. And when I looked at them closely this year, I saw that there was a root from the healthy stem that appears to be kind of wrapping around the base of the other 2, and I'm wondering if that might be the root of my problem, so to speak.
Sure. Well,
if so, is this something that can be fixed potentially?
I would certainly try to fix it right away, and that
okay.
whole concept of girdling root, especially when you've got that clump You know, it's very typical to get that. And, you know, in nature, one of those is going to become more dominant. It grows more quickly, is able to have the carbohydrates to produce more root system, and it's going to overtake the others. Having a clump like that is not necessarily a natural setting. It's certainly very desirable to see it, and it really creates immediate, you know, width to those particular plants. But if you were to find if there's just that single root going around the others, and if you still want to persist with having that clump shape, try simply carefully cutting off that particular girdling root, being careful to not cut any more off than you need to. That is, don't make too large of a wound, because that can be a source of decay and eventually root rot that also damages the healthiest of those particular stems. But I'm presuming you have a sufficient amount of remaining roots elsewhere that you can afford to lose one of those roots that is more problematic for the remaining two. But don't delay, because it's that impingement that's occurring on the other two that doesn't allow a normal expansion of those stems and literally cuts off the vascular system and will cause, as you point out, that gradual dieback of the remaining two.
Mm-hmm. So I might be able to simply sever that largest girdling root right at the base of the tree where it's coming out?
Well, I would make the severing of the cut not at the base of the tree that's coming out, but rather near where it's doing its damage on the other two.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just one severing cut, or do I actually need to remove a section of that girdling root?
If you were to make that severing cut, and then the part which would be on the far side of that,
mm-hmm.
the distal side, pull mm-hmm. that away, because
okay.
even though it's no longer growing, it's still acting as a mm-hmm. impingement upon those other stems. So pull that away, and then just see how it progresses. You might end up finding that it's that strong remaining stem that is going to be the dominant there, and the other two are just not going to recover. But I would certainly
give it a try
and
mm-hmm.
just
yeah.
And pull that back. But, you know, pull it back carefully. Don't do a lot of digging there. Try to minimize
right.
the disruption to any remaining roots.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
you're
thanks,
welcome,
Joy. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Mary in West Bend, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a couple of questions regarding moving some shrubs, and then I also have an additional question about the hardiness of a particular tree or shrub. We need to move a birch, which is about 4 years old, and then also a lilac and a viburnum, which were installed last year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when the birch is, can the birch be moved, do you think, if it's 4 years old?
How big was it when you put it in?
I would say it was probably a good 10, maybe a little taller than that, 10 feet tall.
10 feet tall or
yeah.
taller.
It was
well,
a bigger tree.
Mm-hmm. The key to success in transplanting, especially after 4 years, I mean, it's really, you know, gone beyond that original root ball and has
mm-hmm.
become fairly well established. And the key to moving a larger tree is to have the proper root to crown ratio.
Okay.
So a larger tree is going to require a larger root ball being moved.
Okay.
And so if you possibly can, say that original one, you know, 10 feet tall, probably had what, maybe an 18, at most 24-inch bald and burlap
uh-huh.
root ball that came with it. So now you're going to, if it's at all possible, go another, you know, 12 inches on the outside. I mean, that's a pretty good sized root ball. But
I have someone who's going to be coming in with a professional tree digging thing.
With a tree spade.
Yeah.
Boy,
yes.
Thank goodness for spades. Boy,
okay.
It made all the difference, because you can really get a much larger piece. And, of course, those
okay.
spades come in different sizes also.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievably, up to 90-inch spades locally here.
Oh, boy.
And, of course, if you go south, they even get bigger than that, mm-hmm. Being able to move some huge things.
Okay.
So if you're doing that, yes, and try to do it as early as you can, because if you wait until you are in leaf, you
mm-hmm.
increase the probability of transplant failure, because the tree is losing moisture and you don't want to have that.
Okay.
So know where you want to have it go, you know, and dig it out properly.
Okay. All right.
In terms of the lilacs and the viburnum, they sound like they're smaller.
Yes, they are.
And if they just have been in the ground, you know, for a year, mm-hmm. they really haven't gone much beyond that existing root ball that you moved them in with.
Mm-hmm.
and you know, I don't know, did you take off the burlap when you put them in the ground?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, so you've got the potential as you try to move them. You can try to move those by hand, I take it.
I could, or since the guy's going to be here with the digger, I'll have him, you know, do them that way, if that would be a better way.
Well, I mean, if you're willing to pay the price for that, although it might be overkill and you might end up, you know,
with a bigger hole than I really need.
Well, exactly. So, but if you do move it by hand, assuming that you've got, you know, typical, you know, a silt loam soil that's not going to be, you know, too much sand it's not going to fall apart.
No, there's no chance of that in the dirt that I have here.
Okay, great.
Nothing tips over here.
Then try to get as much of that initial root ball that you can, and just, you know, again, and put some, you know, cardboard or plastic or more burlap underneath it to be able to move it more quickly.
Oh, okay.
And then again, try to do that prior to any bud break occurring.
All right. Now, I've also been reading that, for example, in the case of the birch, that we should not be staking this tree for movement, that they need to move on their own to establish a good root. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
The new theory is that you need to have that movement back and forth to allow the wood to become more rigid. And if you stake anything, it doesn't have the opportunity for that to develop. So, yes, do not stake it unless it's absolutely necessary.
And with that, we need to take a short break here. Our guest today, Bruce Allison, professional arborist, owner of Allison Tree Care Incorporated in Madison, Verona. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. We're talking trees and shrubs today with Bruce Allison, professional arborist, owner of Allison Tree Care Incorporated. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. And if you want to join us, call us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And before we go back to the phones, Bruce, let's talk a little bit. I've mentioned oak trees now a few times, and it really is April 1st is the deadline for pruning trees, and it's really April through July, I believe, in terms of pruning oaks, and that's for protection against oak wilt.
That's right. Oak wilt is a fungus that moves into the tree as a result of fresh wounds at a vulnerable time, usually in the spring months, or can then also move through the root system from an infected tree to a healthy tree if they're close enough. Those are the two ways for the infection to get into oak trees. You know, oak wilt's been around, you know, for, you know, centuries. I mean, it's not really an introduced problem necessarily. It's been around a long time. The early settlers and surveyors made notes of dead clusters of oak trees, you know, back prior to statehood in 1848 when they were doing the surveys for the Northwest Territory. So, you know, we know it's been around a very long time. And there are, you know, some things you can want to avoid, and that's that pruning at the wrong time of year. Now, it used to be we were saying April 15th throughout the state would be the time that you would want to stop pruning. Some more recent research suggests that as our winters become shorter and warmer, and the phenology, that is the moment of the bud break, is occurring earlier on many plants, that at least in the southern part of the state, we need to push that to April 1st as opposed to the 15th. In the northern part of the state, it's still not a problem. It can be after April 15th, but certainly in that lower half of the state, April 1st is when all the pruning of oak should stop. It gets a little bit confusing as you get on the other end of it. The vulnerability from the research that's been done at University of Minnesota and elsewhere is that the tree is only susceptible from that period of bud break to full leaf development, which usually means by, you know, mid-July, that full leaf development and the susceptibility to infection has gone down. Some recent studies here in Wisconsin have shown that when pruning is done after that, you know, no observed incidence of infection. However, you know, other studies make it kind of a little bit murky, so, you know, it's always good to be perhaps a little bit more conservative, and not to make it too confusing, but many municipalities have gone to say, don't prune oaks until after October 1st. the probability of infections in September and even in late August are not high, but if you can, you know, put it off till October 1, why not?
You got a 100-year-old tree out there.
Yeah.
You don't want to take chances with it.
Exactly. It's always a little frustrating to get, you know, not a precise answer from science, but we know for sure that during that period of April, May, June, early July, highly likely to get infections, or that is much more susceptible as a result of a pruning cut.
Leslie and Tomahawk will give you a chance now. Hi, Leslie. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question on flowering crabs. I would love to grow one up here, but we have limited sunlight, about 5 to 6 hours a day. And just wondering if it's even worth trying or if there's any out there that will do with some light filtered shade after that full sunlight that they get?
Hmm. Well, part of the issue with the sunlight, again, is blossoming, because the extra sunlight is needed to have the floral buds formed. But that's not to say that if you're just happy with the leaves and not as dramatic a display of flowers that you can't have some success. There, if you were to go to the University of Wisconsin Agricultural Bulletins or even to the horticulture website at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is our extension university, you will see that our horticulture extension agent, Dr. Laura Jolls, did a very nice job of listing a variety of crab apples and their differing characteristics, speaking also to a little bit more shade tolerance of some, the color of the blooms, the color of the crab apple itself, the normative shape that it would take. The other big issue, especially with not good sunlight, which means you're going to have longer periods of moisture on those leaves, is to look at that scab resistance aspect. Some of those, like Centennial or Red Splendor, maybe even Snowdrift, are going to be more scab resistant, and I certainly would be focusing on that also.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But you've got a huge palette of to select from, and if you have any desire to be artistic, you know, choosing colors and form and shape, you really can have a lot of fun with those crab apples.
Yeah. Good luck. Thanks, Leslie, for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to move to Nellie in Russ County next. Nellie, hi to you.
I've got a source for that gentleman that was looking for the, I don't know whether it was white spruce or white fir.
It was white fir.
White fir.
Yeah, well, they have it at this Chief River Nursery in Ojibwa, Wisconsin.
Oh.
And they say that this is also known as a concolor fir, and it doesn't like clay soils, and it's zone 4 to 6.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want their phone number and website?
Well, if we've got if we go to Chief River Nursery,
.com. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks,
Great,
Nellie.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Chief River Nursery in Ojibwa, place for the white fir. And let's go on to Al in Two Harbors, Minnesota. Hi, Al. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got an orchard that has about 7 trees in it, but one of them on the end is about 8 to 10 inches on the trunk, and it has a Y at about 5 feet. And it had so many apples on it last year that it literally twisted it, both sides of the Y twisted and broke off or split.
Mm.
And I'd like to save the tree, and I'm wondering if I take a chainsaw and cut those Ys back substantially to the trunk, will it resprout off that trunk?
So let's see. Let me make sure I've got the right mental image here. You have an 8 to 10-inch trunk diameter apple.
Yeah, it's probably 25 years old.
About 25 years old, and the trunk comes up, and then it splits into
a Y
at that point.
Yeah.
And so it's the two primary scaffold limbs where you've had the problems.
Yeah, they twisted and split. The tree didn't die. They continued to have their apples even though they're laying on the ground.
No, that's absolutely right. It tells you that overcapacity that's built into the vascular system, it just is able to keep going even though half of it is no longer there. And you're asking, can you cut both of those off, leaving just the main part of the trunk and expect to get resprouting there from an older tree?
They're both broken.
They're both broken. I would say the probability, do you have another scaffold limb coming off of there?
Those are the only two.
And so you essentially have cut off the entire crown of the tree.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, the answer is you will get some trunk sprouting coming from there because malice, the apple species have a very established good root system. They tend to have a lot of suckering coming out. They will tend to create those adventitious buds very rapidly, which is why you've got to do so much pruning on apple trees. So you will get some trunk sprouting, but it won't be a viable tree, especially after 25 years. I would encourage you to, if there is no opportunity to repair in any way the tree, to remove it, replant, and start all over again, because 4 or 5 years from now, you'll be happy to have made that choice as opposed to investing more time in a plant that is really not going to be viable.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's a done name.
It sounds to me like if you have that amount of significant structural damage, that you're not going to be able to revive this particular plant.
If I just cut them off and watch, will it sprout this year?
Yep, it'll sprout this spring. You'll have all kinds of adventitious buds coming out in a part of the trunk that there was no branch before. You have embedded, waiting for the disaster, a bud which is internodulums between the nodes, so that is the buds, and will be stimulated from total lack of other vegetative part to become a shoot that comes out. It'll be a profusion of suckering coming out of there.
But don't expect apples.
Exactly. They certainly won't have apples for a long time, and the attachments of those branches, even though it might keep the plant going, will be poor attachments and eventually very likely break off themselves.
So much as you hate to do it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Al. Probably not the information you wanted to hear, but it's correct information. And as Bruce says, 4 years from now, apples again, and everybody's happy. Let's go back to the phones, and let's see, Ed in Greenleaf is next, I believe. Ed, hi to you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Now that the snow has melted, I'm looking at my French lilacs, and I see that the molds have done in some of the very base on these shrubs.
Oh.
What is the best way? They are still budding, but what is the best way? Should I just go with a tree repair, or what do you think?
Well, you've had those meadow voles, which are voracious eaters during the winter in certain areas, girdle the tree. Is that what you girdle?
Yes.
the lilac?
Mm-hmm.
Very typical. You'll see that in orchards also.
Right.
Well, I don't think they're – well, what percent of the circumference is gone on those?
I don't think they've gotten to the woody area. I think it's just maybe the first layer.
Okay, maybe just some of the bark. So maybe you'll have enough, because if you were to peel that back, the first area is just the bark with what's known as the cork cambium, that is that tissue that grows the bark.
All right.
And then beyond that, you have your vascular area in the vascular cambium. If they sever that all the way to the whitewood, the area of growth on the outside is not going to be able to grow there.
Oh.
And usually if you've had, let's say more than 30 to 40% of that circumference area gone, then you have a very difficult time for the plant to continue to grow, because even though there is that overcapacity that we spoke of earlier with that apple tree that fell apart, nonetheless, if you push it too far, you have insufficient amount of water coming up to be able to service the crown, and quite often you'll get, crown dieback going on. However, with lilacs particularly, if you're not sure exactly how deep it is, it's worth continuing to try to promote it. And I would simply say doing nothing other than making sure there's adequate water, making sure you have good mulch there. Do not introduce fertilizer yet, because fertilizer can actually create additional stress on the plant by forcing extra vegetative growth. What you want is to have stability and have a callus growth grow over that area that has been chewed away by these meadow voles. And then longer term, if these plants are able to survive, and, you know, if it's less than 40%, you know, I don't think there's going to be a big problem. They should be able to keep on growing, and if they were, presuming they were fairly vigorous to begin with, deal with the meadow vole problem by making sure that any grasses around those have been cut down. It tends to, in an orchard or a bedding situation where you have taller grasses, that's where the meadow voles get established. So you want to make sure you cut it down or even mulch it flat so that they don't have the habitat to grow in.
Should I put that wire around it?
Putting a very fine mesh wire, if you've seen the meadow vole, they're a pretty small little creature.
Yeah.
And they can, get through some of that chicken wire pretty easily.
Okay.
I would say probably your best bet, if you're willing to do it and you have a continuing problem, is to, rather than putting the wire around, simply come with some of that tree wrap.
Oh, okay.
And then just wrap up from the base, go higher up, and go high enough to accommodate the fact that you're going to have snow, which is going to allow the meadow vole to get higher up.
You
don't think about that now, but when there's snow, they can be, 2 or 3 feet up. So
will that wrap deter them?
That wrap will be very efficient at deterring them, yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And they also have some plastic wrap, but if you have that wrap that has a sort of a tree wrap that is impregnated with some oil, which keeps the water off, that should be sufficient to take care of the problem.
I'll try that next year. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks, Ed, for calling. And on to Teresa in Heartland. Hi, Teresa.
Hello. I have a question about we just moved into a new home, and we have the trains running 100 feet behind our house. And it can get pretty loud when you're trying to sleep. So I was wondering about pines to put along the berm, or where we should locate them, and how close to space them. And arborvitae along the side of the yard.
There are some arborvitae already there.
And
there,
we've got three huge pines growing on the berm, but the berm ain't very high, but it's a little bit there.
Okay.
And
So, Teresa, what kind of pines do you have growing there right now? Do you have any idea?
I forgot, but I think they might be like a white pine or Austrian pine or something.
Okay, all right.
And I had just planted a Colorado blue spruce, and we've got some white pines that I've planted too.
Okay. Well, so your problem is that you want to have some acoustic screening and quick. You don't want to wait 20 years.
And will putting stones around around the tree and putting mulch under the tree, will that help too, or stones won't do much?
Let's see. Stones aren't going to do much. I mean, stones are usually put in for decorative.
I was wondering.
Exactly, just for color. In fact, there can be some negative associated with stone because it's a masonry, holds heat, and it can sometimes...
Holds heat.
It's because it's masonry or, it's a stone. It holds heat. It has thermal mass to it. And can actually create a little microclimate that can increase the likelihood of having winter damage. So
And I put some around the garden area by the house, the flowers tend to grow weeds so much.
Sure, flowers shouldn't be a problem.
Oh, okay.
So your problem is that you want to have good acoustic screening. You want to have it pretty quick. Those arborvitae, you're already familiar with those. I don't know how old those are, but they've got some new varieties.
They're probably about 5 or 6 years old.
5 or 6 years, so they're probably either the Techne or the dark green.
They look like they've had some problems. They took out a couple of the trees because they died because they had dogs, and I think it's causing them a problem.
Okay, some of the salt
from
the dog.
But now we got somebody new moved in there, so.
Okay.
And there's a big space between it, and I was looking in one of the catalogs, and they have this... which looks like an arborvitae, but I don't know what it is. It's Thuja, green giant.
Yeah, Thuja occidentalis is the scientific name for the arborvitae. And the green giant would be an interesting choice. It's readily available. But you've got several choices in those. So arborvitae would be a choice. You'd want to have them, depending upon how big they are when you bring them in, at 4 to 6 foot spacing. And it doesn't hurt to, rather than have just in a soldier's row, offset them. So have, you know, one and then, you know, go in a sort of a zigzag pattern back and forth.
Yeah, like kind of alternating like in a triangle.
Exactly.
So that's what I've been doing with the trees I've started to put in.
Okay. And so the arborvitae would be a good solution there. Also,
well, just continue with arborvitae like on the side of the house?
If you wanted to sort of
Not on the side, but on the side lot.
Well, the side lot is where the railroad is, right?
Yeah, it's right straight behind us.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then also think about those white pines. I think the white pine would be an excellent choice. It's going to give you some nice green. Eventually, of course, they're going to grow taller, and you'll lose some of those lower branches, but that's going to be many years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that
but
would
be... But what about the spruce?
And if you go to spruce, be thinking about, the Black Hill spruce or the white spruce, which are going to be, you know, closer to the natives and have a nice, dense form. I would not plant any blue Colorado spruce simply because they're more susceptible to things like the Adelgid and Cytospora and Rhizosphera and other problems that can develop over time. But the more native spruce, the white spruce, and one of the variations of that is the Black Hill spruce, I think would be an interesting choice. They're not going to grow as fast as the white pine or the arborvitae, but it doesn't hurt to mix things in. It's always not a bad idea not to put all your eggs in one basket because you never know what's coming down the road there. So if you have a variety, and to do so in an artful, pleasing landscape way, so you just don't have just a wall out there,
but
place them well and have good quality stock. Make sure you have a plan to have adequate amount of water in there, especially during those first 3 or 4 years for development, and use a good mulch at the base so you don't have weeds coming up taking moisture away. And a nice shredded bark mulch would be appropriate underneath that to create a good growing environment for them.
Mm-hmm. Keep the mulch away from the trunk.
Not exactly against the trunk, because you don't want to have the moisture held against the trunk.
All right.
I think that would be a great start, Teresa, and doing it so this spring would be a great idea.
Good luck. Thanks. Taylor in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Taylor.
Yeah, hi. I've got a Elizabeth magnolia tree in the backyard, and it's growing in a raised planter bed that has soil that was one-third compost, one-third loam, and one-third sand.
Hmm.
And it's held by that's probably about 3 feet deep, and it's got a limestone retaining wall maybe 3 feet from the tree.
Okay.
And the tree was very chlorotic last year, and I put ammonium sulfate on it, and it didn't seem to change anything. And I tried some chelated iron, and that didn't change anything. And then this fall, I did put some soil sulfur on it. But I'm wondering if you have any other ideas.
Well, get a pH of the soil before you do any more additions there and see if it's in the right range. It should be in about a 6.3 to 6.7, maybe even 6.8 pH should be sufficient. Take a careful look at that magnolia and make sure that you don't have scale going on. Sometimes scale can create that whiteness and yellowing. It almost looks chlorotic. And you know what scale look like. They're an insect that is going to be on the woody tissue. They suck moisture out, little helmet shapes, scab shapes on that stem itself. You can actually take your hand and kind of, you know, feel that roughness. And at this time of year, they should just sort of, you know, be light and, you know, come out like dried out shells. But make sure that that's not the problem. If that's the problem, you want to be thinking pretty quickly about some dormant oil. And then when they get into the crawler stage later in the summer, if you need to, you can be applying some other forms of insecticide if indeed that's the problem. But sometimes it's not the soil issue, but sometimes you have a very subtle insect like that that can lead to that yellowing
problem
and chlorosis. But check your pH, and yes, adding sulfur is one way to change the pH of the soil.
And thanks a lot for calling in, Bruce. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure. You'll come back again, I assume.
Great. Well, I hope so, Larry.
I hope so, too. Go online, take a look at Bruce's business at allisontree.com. Love to have you do that, allisontree.com. And for more information on trees, our tree board website, treeboard.org, is a good place to go, too. Lots of links, and you'll find a lot of information about trees and tree care there, treeboard.org. And thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.